Esther 1, verses 16 through 18. And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes and to all the people that are in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes, when it shall be reported, the king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought in before him, but she came not. Likewise shall the ladies of Persia and Media say this day unto all the king's princes, which have heard of the deed of the queen. Thus shall there arise too much contempt and wrath. A military council has become a forum for a domestic dispute between the king and his queen. Ahasuerus, who is an absolute monarch, has been repudiated by the queen in a manner that is humiliating. And now he's turning this humiliation, this humiliating event, he's making it a matter of state policy. At the center of this contest are, we're told, seven men. These are the seven men who actually sat as the king's closest advisors. They're present here because they've been with him from the beginning of his reign. Their purpose here is planning to make war with the kingdom of Greece. It appears by this point that the wise men, who knew the times, the magi, that they've opted out of giving advice or consent in this matter. So it now falls to a committee of statesmen whose chief concern has been to plot and plan the upcoming military excursion into Greece. Probably not the best counsel in this particular situation. Consider this, the Council of Seven. They lack the advice of the Magi represented which represents a silencing of the most trusted religious authorities amongst the Persians. The failure to consult with heaven in this matter, even for the Persian, should have been a matter of great concern. They didn't often do that. In fact, it would have been highly unusual and highly irregular. So now they're being asked to give counsel in a situation wherein they have no indication what the heavens or the gods thought. It seems then that for the Hebrews or for the people of God now who are reading the book of Esther, that we're being invited to see that the idols of the heathen are nothing. They're actually dumb idols. They're unable to speak or to give any real counsel. And that's going to be a theme, I believe, throughout this book. The fact is that the idols of the heathen are nothing and reputed as nothing. And here, they're able to do nothing. The customs of the heathen are vain. The religion of the heathen, it's a barren thing. And even if the Magi discerned anything from their judicial astrology, very clearly whatever it was they didn't want to share must not have been very good news for the king. It appears they didn't want to tell him anything if they knew anything. Or perhaps the situation is, as we're told later with the coming of Christ, at that time the heathen all over the Roman Empire, they report that the old oracles that they were following fell silent with the coming of Christ. It may simply be this, that the devils that they worshipped were commanded to be silent as the purposes of Christ unfold here. The fact remains, even for the Persians, this should have been a matter of grave concern. Consider then the silence of the heavens on behalf of the Persian court. You know, it's really paralleling that equal silence that we have of the true God in the book of Esther. Remember, he's not even mentioned. No mention of him. Not directly, anyway. And nevertheless, there is this contest going on. And it's no less of a contest if we understand what the rabbis say. They see this as a second deliverance of the people of God, one akin to Moses and the Exodus. So there's a contest between the gods of Egypt and the God that is the true God. And here, there's a contest between the gods of the Persians who are silent and the silent God who is real. And the God who is going to answer by his deliverance of his people at an appropriate time and in an appropriate manner. He will nowise misstep. And everywhere, the heathen will misstep with or without the guidance of their idols. You know, the silence of the idols in this place, even if it is not the case, even if they were receiving some kind of message, the fact that it's not mentioned here tells us that whatever advice they might have been getting was as good as nothing anyway. But as I suppose, it seems that they've been silenced here. So in contrast to the God who's able to deliver, we have the Persians, who are unable to do or move or come to any good purpose or end. And in contrast to the Persians, who are willing to move forward without apparently any divine input, Mordecai, although again it's not explicit as we shall see, he gives himself over to fasting. And that very action is an indication that he is seeking divine wisdom here. He's seeking intervention, the intervention of the true God in the state of affairs which have arisen in the Persian Empire. Now once more, consider that these seven men, they represent the font of wisdom and counsel for the Persian king. If you remember, as I went through their names, they consist of brothers and seasoned advisors from the time of Darius. These are people in whom Ahasuerus or Xerxes certainly could trust, if he could trust in anyone in the world. These are people who apparently have the best interest of both him and his reign, as well as that of the Medes and Persians together over the world at heart. These people are people who are going to give the best counsel to achieve the ends, the desired ends that they share with this king. As I noted, their names point to their illustrious standing in their community and in the king's court. So together with the king, what they are, what they represent is the combined wisdom and power of the empire. And yet, all of their power and all of their wisdom will be brought to naught. It's going to be parceled out to vanity. It's going to be cast, like all of the idols of man, as Isaiah says in Isaiah 2:20, it's going to be cast to the moles and to the bats. You see, the epitome of human wisdom and power is nothing before the irresistible will of God, who ordereth all things after the counsel of his own will. He doesn't have to take counsel outside of himself. He has full counsel to know what to do and when to do it. So the wisdom of man, the power of man, in its greatest display, is actually here accounted as nothing, even as less than nothing. Think about how this story is unfolding. Remember when I said that this is a story of the greatest miracle that occurs in a series of non-miracles? Think of the great reversal that which has already occurred here. A party in preparation for a military excursion a preemptive victory party from their point of view, followed by another party for the people. This party is now turned into not a military tribunal so much as a political tribunal. And the queen, the wife of the king, has become a defendant in her own empire. A military council has now become a family court. And all of this is being prosecuted in the face of the empire. And of course, all of it is being accomplished, unbeknownst probably to the participants, all of this is going on in order to pave the way for the deliverance of the Jews in this Persian captivity. So here, even in the silence, is the God of heaven. We see him deliberating, designing such a manner that no man can stay his hand or question his right. No one can call him to account. Fact is, like all of these stories in the Bible regarding the people of God, the captives must be redeemed and brought forth with rejoicing. And as improbable as it may seem, the captors themselves will serve as their emancipators. And all of that by reason of the divine decree. So verse 16. And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Vashti, the queen, hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes and to all the people that are in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus. And Memucan answered. Now, according to the Jewish authorities, the name Memucan is derived from a root word which means preparation. Of course, knowing the story, we know that he is preparing the way for the downfall of Persian power. But he's also preparing the way for the deliverance of the people of God. So this tribunal, of which Memucan is the representative, this tribunal actually stands for the fall not only of the Persian power and its replacement by the Greek power, so that we see that continual unfolding foretold in Daniel, but it also is a preparation for the deliverance of these people of God who've remained outside of the Holy Land after the Babylonian captivity. Now his wisdom, as he speaks, is going to prove to be the wisdom of the Lord overruling the efforts of the wicked in order to bring about the salvation of the Israel of God. That's not to say that Memucan is speaking from a position of love to God or concern for real justice. In fact, I'm going to point out that there are reasons to believe that his motives are not pristine. Remember, Memucan was Achaemenes, a full brother of Xerxes or Ahasuerus. The fact that he was mentioned last in the previous verse almost certainly indicates that he was the youngest and perhaps even the least important of the council, even though his name means dignified. I want you to stop and think for a moment on what a contrast then this Memucan is with Elihu in the book of Job. Remember Job 32:4, Elihu had waited till Job had spoken because they were elder than he. Why is it that Elihu waited to speak? Well, he said in verse 7, I said days should speak and multitude of years should teach wisdom. So Elihu was righteous, and that was demonstrated by his hesitance to speak. Mamukin, on the other hand, I think his forwardness indicates and displays an underlying wickedness of character. Fact is that the wicked do in no wise respect their elders. The wicked are quick to speak in their arrogance. In fact, this is a curse of the wicked, that they'll put forth themselves without counsel. And it's a display of the hatred in his heart toward the queen that he's willing to step forward in this matter so quickly. Proverbs 17:9, Solomon tells us, "He that covereth a transgression seeketh love, but he that repeateth a matter separateth very friends." We have no reason to believe then that he had tried to approach the queen privately, or that he ever tried in any way to effect any kind of reconciliation. The question is moved by the king, "What shall we do?" And he seems not even to hesitate to speak out in a manner which is designed to place her sin in its most dismal and damning dimension. Mamukin answered before the king and the princes. In other words, Mamukin's speech is not only designed for the king's ears, but he's clearly, we're told, speaking to the other satraps, the other princes, the other rulers who are before him. So that any appearance of hesitation in our narrative, Mamukin appears to move himself to give the first response. That tells us that he's convinced of his own wisdom, and very likely he's moved by some animosity toward the queen. Maybe some family quarrel. After all, he is Xerxes' younger brother. He never have liked her. We don't know. But he clearly presumes to enter his opinion upon a very thorny subject. Remember, this is a subject which the wise men, the magi, apparently have been reluctant to speak about. They don't want to get involved in this. So what we have is a situation where the wisest men in the kingdom preferred to remain silent, but the presumably youngest counselor of the seven fears not to tread where wisdom dictated silence. Furthermore, as we see, there are elements of Mamukin's speech which are characterized by that slavish submission which was very common amongst the Persian courtiers of the day. I don't want to disagree with the king. You want to move forward in basically giving a rubber stamp to whatever it is you perceive the king wanting to do. Although, as I noted before, there are things in which the king said that indicate that perhaps he's casting about for some reason to find at least some degree of mercy. Nonetheless, Mamukin is not very perceptive. He's not very open to the queen in that regard. Nor is he open to the fact that the king apparently is seeking to find some way of either lessening the punishment or finding some degree of mercy to offer toward the queen. Mamukin has a very different purpose, as we'll see. And Mamukin answered before the king and the princes, "Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only." So note what he does. He begins by acknowledging that the matter before them has to do with none other than the person of the queen. He's clear on that. He understands that. And by mentioning her by name, Vashti, he is, among other things, reminding both himself and his hearers of her remarkable beauty. Remember, that's what her name connotes. And that's the reason why this whole controversy has come about. Because the king wanted to show everyone how beautiful she was to look upon. The difference is that when the Persians were ruling, it was not a time when men had become so effeminate that they had actually allowed themselves to be swayed by beauty. The concerns of real men at this time were not with how beautiful women were. They were there for the taking. Their concerns had to do with power and the exercise of power. And Mamukin begins by saying something that recognizes that there was wrong done to the king, though not only to the king. He acknowledges that the king has a legitimate complaint. That's really what is couched here. But he's saying, look, it's not only a wrong done to you. So instead of trying to find mercy, what is he doing? He's going to try to aggravate her sin and show the king that she is deserving of the most severe punishment. Now, the word translated wrong, Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, that word signifies a deviation or a perversion from a known or received standard. In other words, he's very clearly indicating, if we go back and remember that perhaps Ahasuerus is trying to mitigate and say, well, look, maybe she refused to come because I didn't go myself. Maybe it's because she was really just refusing those chamberlains I sent, the eunuchs. Mamukin is saying, no, this isn't just an oversight. This is a violation of a custom. In fact, it's a custom which might even be reflected in some of the legal statutes of the Persians, if we think about this for a few minutes. As I say, it shouldn't be surprising that Mamukin begins his assessment with this agreement with the king, because that's what courtiers did. In fact, it would have been surprising if he had offered any resistance to the king's initial complaint. Because the fact is, as I say, these courtiers at the time, they seldom dared to contradict even the most capricious decisions that a monarch, an absolute monarch, would make. He wielded nearly absolute power. There are very few restraints. Nonetheless, as I've said, in this case, this Persian monarch, at least in this instance, seems open to finding some restraint upon his actions. He presented a case where he may have already begun to lay the groundwork for finding mercy. Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes. That's what Mamukin is going to say here. He's drawing out what he believes to be her aggravating circumstances. So if the king is cutting in one direction, Mamukin is taking it in another direction altogether. Indeed, he's saying the queen has offered offense to the king, but she didn't do so merely in his private capacity. This wasn't something that happened in their domestic chamber, out of sight of the people or those around him. What she did as the king sat with his council. And furthermore, she offended him in a time of public festivity. So he's arguing her offense was public, it's not private. This isn't just a domestic matter. It really is a matter of state. It's not private. It involves, in some sense, he's asserting, the very center of his governing. And he's saying that because he's indicating that her offense takes in the person of the king as he sat as this absolute monarch surrounded by his coterie of princes. Thus, according to Memucan, what she did was she had violated the custom or the statute respecting the princes or the satraps, those who ruled together with the king, those who were taken into his council. She's not only guilty of some small domestic infraction. No, this is something she did, and she did it publicly and with respect to the seat of government. So had the king been inclined to find some mitigating circumstance or perhaps even some precedent for abandoning his initial harsh conclusion, which, remember, was something that had arisen from his anger, Memucan here is pressing the king toward a very different direction. Instead of mitigation, Memucan is saying there's aggravation. And he's not finished with his presentation. He thinks this aggravation is much greater, much broader, much deeper, much more serious than the king may have perceived. If actually the queen had done wrong, and not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes and to all the people that are in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus. When Vashti refused to come, it was not only a breach and offense before the king and his court. Memucan is saying it's an offense which is actually offered to all the people of the various provinces, all 127. Because these rulers that sat with him, these satraps, they were the rulers, the princes over those provinces. So in this, Memucan is refining his criticism and pressing his prosecution of the queen. Now, I think that what he is rightly asserting here is this. The offenses of those who hold high office. Because remember, they keep mentioning the fact she's acted here not merely as a wife, but as a queen. So these offenses of those who are holding high office are very striking offenses. And he views these offenses very strictly. And he seeks a very severe verdict against these offenses precisely because she holds such high office. And thus, as we shall see, he concludes she should face serious consequences because her offense is highly punishable. And it is not an offense that he's inclined to mitigate. In fact, he thinks it's aggravated by reason of office and by reason of circumstance. She not only refused the king, but she'd done so in a place and at a time when her refusal would be widely exposed to the general public. And that's what he goes on to say in the next verse. For this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes, when it shall be reported the king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought in before him, but she came not. For this deed of the queen, that is, for the matter of the queen. In other words, it's not only what she's done. The word here that's used here is a more general word. I think it has to do, the idea is the ramifications of what she's done. So it not only includes then the action, the deed, it includes the interpretation or the spin that the people are going to place upon her actions. You know, the conclusions they're going to draw when they realize what the queen has done. Here Memucan then is reminding the king and those who are gathered with him that Vashti acted not merely as a wife in private, but she did so as queen. And as queen then, she set forth an example It's going to find imitation and support amongst others because people, generally speaking, people follow their leaders. See, none live unto themselves, but public personages especially bear responsibility to those over whom they're placed. For this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women. The thing committed by the queen is queen shall come abroad unto all women. Remember, the queen was in charge of the feast for the women. Queen is setting an example for the women. Queen is, in fact, putting on display the kind of behavior, the kind of actions which are deemed appropriate for the women. That's precisely why in the post-Christian West, they have such difficulty with the wives of politicians who behave as wives and not as statesmen. Because they don't like that fact that those women who behave as wives are actually instructing and having influence over other women to behave like women. We'll come back to that. By its very nature, what the queen has done is going to be repeated through the provinces. And it's going to be of special interest among all the women. The women are going to hear of this, then they're going to speak of it among themselves. So it's going to take on a life of its own. It's going to become fodder for gossips. And it's going to become the subject of insubordinate contemplation. This deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes. Now, this seems to be the crux of the matter. You see, just as Vashti had despised her husband, she, as queen, has set an example which shall be emulated and imitated by the women in the various provinces. That's a concern here. The verb despise in the Hebrew is in the hifel. It's causative. Memucan is saying very clearly then that Vashti, by her behavior, has caused or will cause widespread marital disturbances. And worse. She's going to do this by causing other women to despise. Now the word despise means not merely to treat badly, but particularly it means to subjugate. This is a peculiar temptation that all women face since the fall of mankind. Genesis 3:16. Unto the woman he, that is God, said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. Now, the import of that is that what God is saying is that women, fallen women, are going to desire to rise up, to subjugate their husbands. But the husbands, in the end, will, in fact, put down this rebellion and rule over them. Now, Vashti, then, rather than demonstrating an appropriate submission to her husband, refused to come when he called her. Now, this is bad enough. But the fact that she acted as queen, and that she was now placing her actions forth as an example that might suggest that this was proper behavior for women, that is an aggravation. Now, although it's been suggested that she refused to come for modesty's sake, I've already addressed this, I think. It doesn't appear that this was really her motivation, though legitimately it might have been. So this, it must be noted then, roots her action in her own vanity, rather than a concern for a higher standard of morality. She's not concerned about morality. She stands condemned here as a proto-feminist rebel. And as Mamoukin recognizes, should this challenge stand unrebuked, it actually poses a threat to all social order and domestic stability within the empire. This deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes when it shall be reported. Now I want you to listen to what he said, when it shall be reported. This matter shall not remain concealed. That's his absolute certain judgment. It's not going to remain concealed. By the very nature of the crime and the occasion of the crime, it will become public. And when it does, he's saying, the consequences foretold will begin to be seen rocketing throughout the kingdom. This action of Vashti with respect to Ahasuerus is such that it's going to generate a lot of conversation. And it's going to generate a lot of rebellion. It will be reported. It's going to be spoken about. Mamoukin understands it's not if, but when this comes to the knowledge of the public. That's the fact. It's going to come out. And at that time, it's going to capture the attention of the people, especially women who are most inclined to cast off a proper submission to their husbands. They're the women who are going to be most tempted and provoked by this example. It's not every woman, but all women are going to feel it. They're all going to feel that pinch. They're all going to feel that temptation. And that includes, by the way, the Jewish women. And so this is something which, when we see the story of Mordecai and Esther, Mordecai has to address this, and Esther has to behave in a way very contrary to Vashti in order to counteract this among the Jews and then among all of the people. For this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes when it shall be reported. The king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought in before him, but she came not. Specifically, Mamoukin now recounts the nature of the offense. The king, who's also her husband, the king commands that Vashti, who's also the queen, be brought before him. The emphasis here is upon their official capacity, and that underscores the aggravating circumstances attending any deviation from the command. As I said before, should he merely have been her husband, Vashti should have given attendance to him. Paul says in Ephesians 5:22, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. Of course, this submission is to be in the Lord. It's not to be a submission in things which are sinful. However, even in things adiaphora, even in things which are otherwise indifferent, there's to be a submission. There shouldn't be a complaining. There shouldn't be a pushback. There certainly shouldn't be an out-and-out refusal. As I said, Vashti, though she might have, she didn't plead that she thought that there was something untoward or immodest in coming before the king and his council. Her action is offered up as an arbitrary refusal. And maybe, I believe as I indicated before, it might have been some misused sense of exercising your own freedom. But it's precisely this refusal that is striking at the authority of the man. And moreover, as Mamoukin is stressing here, this is an example of a queen disobeying the king. Thus, he's arguing domestic insubordination in this case very clearly does spill over into the public realm. He commanded, she didn't come. There is an element of direct disobedience that he's pointing out in here. You might want to say that there's some mitigation. He didn't come himself. He sent his courtiers. He sent his chamberlains, his eunuchs, and she didn't come because he didn't come himself. But Mamukin is saying, look, no right-thinking person is going to agree that she didn't understand that seven chamberlains showing up to bring her back are somehow misrepresenting the will of the king. The greatness of the queen's station aggravates her misstep. And the grandeur of her person is exactly what calls for a greater condemnation and punishment. Mamukin's case is that the king mustn't think of his own concerns in this matter. He must consider the interests of all the subjects. So he continues. Likewise shall the ladies of Persia and Media say this day unto all the king's princes, which have heard of the deed of the queen. Thus shall there arise too much contempt and wrath. Likewise shall the ladies of Persia and Media. And here now I think we really get to the heart of Mamukin's concern, his real concern. Just as all of the women in the empire are going to be tempted by this example, Mamukin fears that the ladies, the wives of the nobility, the princesses, are going to follow this example as well. And thus, the princes or the satraps that sat in council with the king ought to be concerned lest they return home to domestic disputing with their own wives. Mamukin, therefore, as I said, is not really offering counsel or advice from any kind of position of detachment or any sort of fair and balanced neutrality in this situation. In fact, he confesses himself to be very much prejudiced against the queen in this matter. His appeal to the concern for the people, in fact, might well move the heart of the king. Because the king should be concerned about his people. Here it's a pretext for his very severe motion against the queen. Likewise shall the ladies of Persia and Media say this day unto all the king's princes. See, the ladies of the nobility amongst the Persians and the Medes are going to reply to all the princes of the king in like manner as did Vashti to the king. Look what he says. It's going to happen this very day. Likewise shall the ladies of Persia and Media say this day. In other words, he's saying, this is not a matter that we can put off indefinitely. This is not something which can await further deliberation. This is a matter which requires your prompt attention. Already, the results of what she did are being felt. The ramifications are being displayed throughout this kingdom. Already, perhaps, the women were beginning to take their cue then from the queen. Now, the women that he has in mind here, the wives of the princes, very likely are already in Susa, somewhere near or in relatively close proximity to these princes. So the seething rebellion that's going on was quite likely already apparent to those who are seated in this council. They can see what's going on. Likewise shall the ladies of Persia and Media say this day unto all the king's princes which have heard of the deed of the queen. Example of the queen is presented as a pretext for the rebellion of the wives of the princes. Vashti's insubordination has spread or will spread very quickly throughout the empire. Especially to the wives of the nobility. No sooner, in other words, do they hear than they are set forth as affected by it. It's already having an effect. What these people do has an effect, and the effect is very rapid. Who can tell how far this disturbance goes? But as Mamukin is indicating here, it appears already it's becoming a problem, or he fears it's going to be a problem for the princes themselves. And thus shall there arise too much contempt and wrath. The result of this spreading rebellion is twofold. First, it will breed contempt. The word contempt here implies an undervaluing or an according of too little worth to something. Second, it's going to breed wrath or discord. These are the two things he's worried about. We'll talk about those in just a minute. From all of this, we can observe that humility demands we exercise discretion and that we present ourselves as slow to offer advice, especially in those situations wherein wiser men have thought it best to remain silent. Conversely, seeing the answer and the advice which has been offered here by Mamukin, we should be cautious about accepting advice from those who are not disinterested parties, particularly in cases that demand a certain amount of detachment in order for there to be a balanced counsel. We are, as Scripture says, to be quick to hear but slow to speak. Now, Mamukin, in this case, seems not only quick to speak, but he also seems far from willing to consider all sides in hope of arriving at a more just sentence. And this is the case, even though, as I've said, the king himself seems to signal that he's trying to find mitigating circumstances so that he might temper his judgment with mercy. But consider as well this. Submission to those whom God has placed over us is not something that we in our corrupt natures often find to be very pleasant or very agreeable. In fact, it's a mark of increased sanctification and growth in grace that makes us malleable and compliant with that authority. It's our pride. It's our pride that continually tempts us to rise up and to assert that we have some kind of equality with those who are our superiors. And that's precisely why there are so many undutiful sons and so many disobedient wives. Thus, the danger for us in bad examples. We are all too ready to follow the evil examples which most comport with our sinful nature, or our sin nature. Our prevailing corruption drives us to rebellion. It drives us to disobedience. It drives us to an undutifulness toward those whom God has set over us. Vashti's example, then, would set that bad example for the women of the nobility, and they in turn would spread the acceptance of this kind of feminist rebellion amongst the lower classes. Lest we misunderstand, I think Mamukin is correct in some things he says here. His motives may not be correct, but what he says is very much to the point. When women rebel against their husbands, it spawns contempt. Because what it really represents is an undervaluing. It represents an undervaluing of the social order which God has set in this world. And He's put it in the very nature and fabric of families. And so a family becomes a school of rebellion instead of a school of submission to the providential orderings of nature. And when that happens, every kind of unnatural practice and ungodly, unnatural desire arises. It undervalues the nature of men. When women despise their husbands, they teach their children to cast off restraint. But that's not all they're doing. What they do is they instill in their girls a masculine impulse, while at the same time instilling in their boys a feminine bent. They push their children into contempt, and that contempt destroys familial unity. That's why Vashti's rebellion is such a serious matter. It divides, and it leads to the conquest of those consigned to its wake. Additionally, it raises wrath. Why? Why is it productive of anger? Anger is the attempt to assert power, to reassert power, when it is being taken from someone. You know, when you're powerless, when you feel like you have no power, you feel nothing but shame. But when you feel like you can take back that power, you feel anger. And that's why it brings anger. And this anger actually arises from several sources in these natural and civil families in which women teach this insubordination to their children. Fathers and husbands are frustrated. They're angered because they sense that this rebellion is going to undermine all efforts to conserve unity of purpose and direction. It wastes their time and their resources. And wives themselves become angry in this because their rebellion will never accomplish what they really desire to achieve. Women will never, ever become equals with men. And so all that they're going to do is they're going to press more and more for remedies designed to achieve the unachievable. And they do it angrily. With each push, the futility of their project becomes more evident, and the level of their anger will grow. Children will become angry as they're faced with the same futility because they will never be equals to their parents. All they can do is bring ruin to themselves and to their family. But they will never be equals to their parents. And they need to beware because God is not mocked. What a man sows, he shall surely reap. Those who sow discord as children will reap discord in their own children. So wives should be obedient to their husbands if they would achieve real peace and happiness. There's no genuine gratification to be found in advancing your pride. Pride cometh before the fall. There will never be satisfaction in indulging in perverse and rebellious behavior. See, the fact is this, men by nature, men know that their wives and that women in general have no right to domineer over them. Whether openly or not, they're provoked at that kind of behavior that seeks to usurp their place. And they can never be truly pleased with or find any satisfaction in women who do these kinds of things. Oh, it's true. They might for a time yield to womanly authority rather than live in a state of perpetual war. I mean, even Solomon said it's better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman and in a wide house. Nonetheless, their disposition towards their wives is going to be soured. Their love for them will be quenched, and their affection is going to be turned into an aversion. The end result is this, that men will come to view their wives as tyrants and enemies, rather than as loving companions who are heirs together of salvation and true helpers through life. Husbands are soured by domineering wives, and they come to despise, sometimes secretly, sometimes openly, those women that live in rebellion to male authority. They can't stand them. They may hide it. But if there's any masculine impulse left, if they have any testosterone left in them, they hate it. Children must yield obedience to parents if they find true peace and prosperity in life. Ephesians 6. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee and thou mayest live long on the earth. Your disobedience breeds trouble and even premature death. There's no wisdom in pursuing your own pleasure at the expense of obedience to lawful authority. And there's no prosperity, for the end of disobedience, like all sin, is death. It brings a curse upon yourself and those who were entangled in that rebellion with you. Now think about this. Contempt and wrath in families is of such a severe nature that even the heathen then have recognized this as something that must be quelled with the most harsh punishments. It's no mistake then, the Apostle Paul, in giving marital instruction, always begins with the case of women. And listen to what he says. Colossians 3:18, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as it is fit in the Lord. 1 Timothy 2:11 and following, let the woman learn in silence with all subjection, but I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence. For Adam was first formed, then Eve. Likewise, the Apostle Peter says, you wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may, without the word, be won by the conversation of the wives. Notice he doesn't say, nag them. He doesn't say, cajole them. He doesn't say, usurp authority over them. He says, no. He says, obey. Win them over by your conversation, while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear. Whose adorning, let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair, or wearing of gold, or putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart, and that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. For after this manner in the old time, the holy women also who trusted in God adorned themselves, being in subjection to their own husbands. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well and are not afraid with any amazement. Paul's order. Women are commanded to obey their husbands. And afterward, men are commanded to love their wives. See, since the fall, it's already difficult for men to love their wives. But when women aren't submissive to them, it makes it close to impossible. That principle of rebellion destroys all affection that a man can have for a woman. Because this rebellion, you have to understand, this rebellion is actually destroying what is feminine. And it's elevating a masculine principle in the woman, which every man who's not plagued with unnatural affections will find repulsive. And finally, we have to recognize the power of imitation here. Evil communications really do corrupt good manners. And as Solomon says, a companion of fools will be destroyed. But Paul says, be therefore followers of God as your children, and walk in love as Christ also hath loved us, and hath given himself for us in offering the sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling savor. Vashti's rebellion has sown the seeds of discord, and it will bring about her destruction together with all of those who follow her. At the same time, all of this, as I've said, is appointed for the deliverance of the people of God. And on the other side of the story, there is the story of Esther and Mordecai, who are going to serve as examples of well-doing, which the apostle might well refer to when he says in Hebrews 13:7, remember those which have the rule over you, who have spoken unto you the word of God, whose faith follow, considering the end of their conversation. Consider the end of both of these. Consider the end of Vashti, and consider the end of Esther. Consider the end of Ahasuerus and his kingdom, and consider the end of Mordecai and the people of God. Behold then in this story the grace of God, who can bring out of this most unnatural evil of family discord the good of his salvation. And the reason is because only God can bring good out of evil, and only God can redeem that which is unredeemable for us. And that's what he's doing throughout Esther. And that we will see as we continue. Amen.